Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Okay, so it's my great pleasure to introduce for the last seminar of this series my colleague and friend Gennaro Chierchia from Harvard University. Gennaro obtained his PhD at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and then held positions in different American universities, Brown, Cornell. Then he came back to Europe, and for many years he was in Milan, professor of linguistics at Milano Bicocca, and then he went back to the United States. I was thinking 10 years ago, but it's more than 10 years ago, right? It's more 20 years ago. Yeah, you know, the years fly. So he's at Harvard. He's been at Harvard, in fact, for the last 20 years. Gennaro Chierchia is, of course, a major figure in the domain of formal semantics. Some of his contributions are extraordinarily important and influential on various topics, polarity items, implicatures, all sorts of other things, mass and count nouns, the interpretation of pronominal dependencies, and I think that today's contribution is about the topic of pronouns and how they are interpreted. So welcome to Paris, and thank you very much.
Luigi, thank you so much. This is, you know, a great honor to be part of this event. Luigi and I go back a long, long time. And in fact, even though we are the same age, he was my teacher. He was a very young visiting professor when I was a finishing graduate student. And it's fair to say that you changed the course of my life. And so it's touching for me to be here today, and I don't know what I'm going to say, because I will be thinking about the momentousness of this event all the time. Let me start by going back to a topic that Luigi addressed a few classes back, which is the topic of constraints on coreference. So this is a very well-known data point. If you have a sentence like, she scolded Sue's friend, she cannot be Sue. You cannot interpret she as Sue. But if you say, her dad scolded Sue because she acted irresponsibly, here you can. Okay. And speakers develop rich intuitions about when pronouns can co-refer or co-vary with an antecedent, which may linearly precede, or, as in this case, follow the pronoun. Now, in the cases like 1 and B, it is a matter of coreference. In cases like C, however, we talk about covariation or binding. So, in front of his house, nobody wants a nuclear waste dump. The way you interpret this sentence is as shown in C. So, this sentence means John doesn't want a nuclear waste dump in front of John's house, Mary doesn't want a nuclear waste dump in front of Mary's house, and so on for all the relevant people. So, this sentence is a particular statement about Sue. But this sentence is a general statement. And this generality comes from the noun phrase nobody, which is a quantified noun. And the semantic import of quantified nouns can be stated in this form, which is, you know, sounds like, immediately sounding like logic. So, for no person X, X wants a garbage dump in front of X's house. Okay. So here, the pronoun is interpreted as a referential device, but here, it is interpreted in a general way, as a device for creating a general reference, a general thought, that enables to make a statement about a potentially infinite set. Okay. And this is what quantifiers and variables, quantifiers meaning noun phrases and variables meaning pronouns, can do. And this is an extremely powerful tool of reasoning. Without quantifiers and variables, there is no logic and there is no science. Science could not develop. And so this talk is about the roots of this fundamental capacity of expressing general statements through quantifiers in natural language. When is it that quantified nouns can covary with pronouns, and when is it that they cannot? And why? And in view of the huge cross-linguistic variation, this is a very hard question. But as it turns out, there are some pretty remarkable generalizations that hold, and some of them have fairly simple explanations. And this is what I would like to illustrate today. And, you know, it is a collective result of modern linguistics to arrive at some such generalizations and explanations. As you know, if you have been following Professor Ritz's class, structure matters. That is very obvious. And by structure, I mean the way in which words are assembled in phrases, which we linguists represent as trees. So, for instance, in this case, in sentence A, the pronoun, we say, she commands, is antecedent. That is to say, if you climb up to the first branching node and look down, then you see the potential antecedent. Okay? Here, the pronoun does not see command its potential antecedent. Obviously, this matters. In this case, this blocks coreference. But in this case, coreference can take place. Okay? So let me give you some more of these facts. Scope and binding are technical terms that linguistics imported from logic. So inverse scope is a familiar interpretive option throughout the languages of the world. By inverse scope, I mean this. If you have a sentence like, some technician inspected every plane, this has two readings, one in which there is a technician that inspected every plane, and one each where for every plane there is a possibly different technician that inspected it. This second option, for instance, is not available in this sentence. Some technicians who inspected every plane was arrested. Here the technician has to be one. Right? But in the first sentence, it can covary with the plane. Okay? And so this is a situation of inverse scope, where the object, which is embedded deeper down, takes scope over the subject. Okay? And I invite you to think about this phenomenon as a sort of a mental movement, where you literally take the object and process it before the subject, so that the sentence winds up having the reading, for every X which is a plane, there is a possibly different technician Y that inspected it. Okay? And this is familiar in certain configurations like this, but not in here. And now a puzzle arises, namely, even though inverse scope is possible, inverse binding, inverse covariance, is very rarely possible. Okay. So it is not possible to construe this as meaning every student X is such that X complained to himself. It cannot have this interpretive construal. Now, is this a matter of left to right? Something simple like that? Well, not obviously so if you consider questions, right? The same point can be illustrated with questions. So this is, in English, kind of an echo question. It's very restricted. It's not the way you normally ask questions. It's not ungrammatical. You can say it, but it has special pragmatic conditions, right? So he complained to whom? This is a form of a regular question. Who did he complain to? Now, this is a perfectly fine question if you don't interpret it with who binding he. So this cannot mean which X is such, X complained to X. Okay? So you see, here, the WH word occurs to the left of the potential target binder, bindee, but still, the relevant interpretation is impossible. And so, you know, there is a descriptive generalization here that you can, and you can sort of encompass both this and this in the same statement, if you wish. So, a pronoun cannot covary with either a noun phrase or the trace of a noun phrase that it commands. So if the pronoun is above, it cannot covary with something below. And this is known as a strong crossover. Okay? It's a very widespread constraint. Now, strong crossover has a lesser brother, which is called weak crossover. And it's represented by this sentence. So, you know, his brother likes no one. Again, it's difficult or impossible to interpret his as combining with no one. And this difficulty extends to WH question in much the same way as this does. So who does his brother like? It's very hard to interpret this as who is such that his brother likes him. It's really not a natural way to interpret that question, right? And then you see something parallel between these two configurations like this, right? And the descriptive statement is that a pronoun embedded within a subject cannot covary with a quantified element that it commands. Okay. There have been proposed accounts for these two constraints in the history of our discipline. For instance, the standard way to understand this is in terms of Chomsky's theory of binding, which became sort of a standard fixture of modern linguistics since the 80s. And this theory governs the relation between a possible antecedent and a pronoun. So it is a theory of covariation, the phenomenon that I've introduced you to at the outset. And it is based on three principles. This is the last one. Two of them are quite intuitive. This one is very hard. This one is the most complex of the principles of Chomsky's binding theory. The first two, let me get to them first, are quite intuitive, and they govern the distribution of reflexive and non-reflexive pronouns. So a reflexive pronoun must have an antecedent nearby, and a non-reflexive pronoun cannot. Okay, so this means that John thinks that Mary likes herself. That's good, because herself finds a local antecedent in Mary. But John thinks that Mary likes himself. That's not good, because, you know, himself doesn't have a suitable local antecedent. And John likes him. Him cannot be interpreted as John, because John is too close. Okay, so these are intuitive. Principle C, which is the last principle that governs the crossover phenomena, that's very hard. Okay, that's sort of not readily graspable. Okay, so it says that a trace, that is to say, an element created by the movement of a quantifier, cannot be argument bound. Oh my God, what does that mean? So it means co-indexed with a potential antecedent that sits in an argument position. What is an argument position? Is a position to which a canonical major grammatical relation gets assigned. So a subject, an object, the object of a preposition. I still have in my ears Luigi's words when he was teaching the binding theory to me in my graduate student years. I still remember him explaining this to me as if it was today. Okay, and so I thought that before fading out, I should give it back to him. This is basically the account of strong crossover. Okay, a strong crossover configuration arises when you move something and there is this guy in between on the C command line that, as it were, interferes with the trace. Weak crossover, quite frankly, is a mess. There are no agreed upon solutions. And I have been, so this is like Cicero pro domo sua. I think that there is a semantic framework that has come out, is almost as old as my scientific life. It came out around the mid-80s. And it has steadily grown since. And it's called dynamic semantics, or dynamic logic. And it's a view that integrates classical semantics and classical logic with an idea about how information unfolds on the basis of the semantics of the major connectives and quantifiers. Do not worry, I'll tell you all you need to know about it. But I think that there is a solution to this crossover problem that is embedded in that framework. And I would like to tell you about it. So these are the narrower goals of today. I would like to expand a bit the range of crossover phenomena to be considered. extended to data that are familiar but unaccounted for, but also to data that are quite new. And then I would like to get rid of principle C. And in fact, I would like to get rid of it in favor of something else that Professor Rizzi has worked on a lot, namely minimality, which is a computational property, a property of computational systems. And consider possibly some further benefits of binding, of relating the binding theory with this dynamic tail. So this is how I will proceed. I will first give you the broad generalization to be addressed. Then I will tell you about dynamics. And then I'll try to show how that works with respect to this broad range of data. Okay, and there are two sets of facts that I want to talk about. This is well known, but unaccounted for, or with no agreement on how it should be treated. So this is, again, a case of binding and covariance. Which we don't know how to handle very well. Because you see here, consider this sentence, every big city's mayor, or the mayor of every city, presented a different motion. Okay? So here you see every has scope over motion. So every city gets a different motion, right? But everything is not a co-argument. It's embedded within a noun phrase. It's buried inside a noun phrase. When that normally happens, you cannot scope outside of it. So for instance here, the mayor that visited every big city wrote a report on it. This has to be a unique mayor, right? You see, the quantifier is embedded inside the noun phrase, and it cannot scope out of it here. But it can here, and it can even bind pronouns. Okay? So there is something special about the possessor position, or, you know, certain prepositional phrases inside the noun phrase, that enable to outscope the noun phrase and to bind pronouns that normally would be not within its reach. Okay? So this is a well-known problem, and it's unknown, unagreed upon how to deal with it. Now, this type of constructions display terrifyingly strong crossover phenomena. So you see, this is almost unintelligible. It totally ruined every big city's mayor. Now, why? Because if you assign scope to this, right, and if the possessor can escape, then why cannot it bind like that? And this is slightly more intelligible. I mean, you can see what this is trying to say, but it's equally impossible, right? So its corruption totally ruined every city's mayor. Like, you can sort of see what that would mean, but it's just not the right way to say it. And again, why? Right? Because if, you know, we know that we can assign scope of objects, right? So this is a very, very strong, both strong. So this is called secondary strong crossover. The name comes from Paul Postol, as much in this domain. And this is secondary weak crossover. Secondary because the potential binder is inside a noun phrase. Okay. This is another thing that we love. This has been the primary hunting ground for the dynamic take. These phenomena are known like have the inglorious name of donkey anaphora. From you know, it's an old problem. So every farmer who beats a donkey gets beaten by its mother. This is a silly sentence, but you perfectly understand what it means. And here, it's covaris with a donkey, which is again buried inside a noun phrase. No problem. If you flip them around, it becomes unintelligible again. So, its mother bites, every farmer who beats a donkey is gibberish. And again, why? Right? You take the object, you scope it. We know that from that position binding is possible. Why is it not possible here? Notice there is a minimal contrast that is important. So this is so-called DP donkey anaphora. Well, the anaphora is buried inside a noun phrase. But this is instead here. This is also donkey anaphora, but it's adverbial donkey anaphora. So the quantifier here is an adverb. Okay, so if a cat has blue eyes, it always is aggressive, or it rarely is aggressive. If a cat has blue eyes, it rarely is aggressive, means few blue-eyed cats are aggressive. Right? Here, no crossover at all. If it has blue eyes, a cat is rarely aggressive, it's just as perfect. Okay. And an interesting thing, there are languages that are said not to have quantifiers like every. So determiner quantifiers are not universal. Adverbial quantifiers are. There is no known language that lacks adverbial quantifiers. So this is an important data point to bear in mind. Okay. Right, so these are is something clearly, you know, a theory of crossover should extend to these cases, should make us understand what is going on. No? These are the kind of things that are pretty clear, but fairly, imagine a child converges on these intuitions eventually. And here is a set of fairly new facts, and this bear upon the talk that Luigi gave today, right? So it concerns a kind of topic-oriented movement. And let me illustrate it with an abstract example from English, and then I will give you some concrete examples from three languages. So, he praised every student's work. Here, every student cannot bind he. His teacher praised every student's work. Same thing. This is strong crossover, secondary strong crossover. This is secondary weak crossover. Now, imagine being able to topicalize the object to front it, which in English is impossible with quantified DPs, but it's possible with referential ones, like Luigi used in his previous talk, okay? So every student's work he praised, in English is bad, but if it was good, this binding would be impossible. And you see that with the referential thing. Not John's work he praised, he cannot be John. The sentence is good, but not if he is John, okay? So, secondary strong crossover remains ungrammatical if you topicalize. Okay, but look at what happens with secondary weak crossover. Again, this is bad in English because you cannot topicalize quantified DPs. So, every student's work, his teacher praised, this in English is not good. But if it was allowed, the coreference would be, the covariation would be fine, which you see here. John's work, his teacher praised. Okay, so this is the generalization. This topic-oriented movement still obeys strong crossover, but forgives weak crossover. What the hell is going on? Okay. Let me give you the real facts, okay? They are from three languages. These are the Hindi translation of these sentences. Okay, the explicit Hindi translation of these sentences. In Hindi, you can locally scramble, and scrambling, local scrambling is similar to a form of topicalization, and you see exactly this pattern. Okay? Now, I want to tell you, you know, the same holds of Italian clitic left dislocation, so you can apply that, I expect, to French. This is Siddig pivot movement. I want to talk about that. Why get into exotic stuff like Italian? We'll do Austronesian. But before we do that, I want you to give a sense of what is going on with English, where something very similar holds if you look at prepositional phrases, which you can front. Like, you know, in adverb fronting type thing. So this is the pattern, and this will give you some intuitions about what is going on. So he burst into tears at every student's defense. He cannot be every student. His advisor burst into tears at no student's defense. That's pretty, it's intelligible, but not the way to say it. Now, fronted, at every student's defense, he burst into tears. The sentence is grammatical, but not on that reading. Or at no student, you can even do negative inversion, at no student's defense, did he burst into tears. That's still bad, on the covariant interpretation. But, look, at every student's defense, his advisor burst into tears, or at every student's defense, and no student's defense did his advisors burst into tears, that becomes completely perfect. Okay? So these exotic things that happens in Hindi and in Italian clitic left dislocation and whatnot happens in our own backyard. Okay. I have to tell you about Siddig because I am new to it. I know nothing about Austronesian. But this is, you know, when you look at this, you think that this has been planted by Chomsky. That is not a real natural language. Look at what happens. So this is field work on this Austronesian language, which is spoken in Taiwan by Yvette Wu. She has an ELS paper, which is coming right out. And this language is pretty amazing when it comes to anaphora. And anyone who thinks that anaphora has anything to do with left to right should look at this. So the way it works, so it's described usually as either a VSO or a VOS language. Okay, now, the way Austronesianists talk about this is that there is a basic underlying order, possibly SVO, certainly verb first, and then an overlay of what they call pivot movement. So there is a morphology that tells you which argument has to be the pivot. Now, the pivot sits on the right. Okay? So you can take the agent as pivot, the patient as pivot, or allocation as pivot. Okay, and it's obligatory, you have to do that. Okay, so look what happens with pivot movement. So probably, you know, the pivot sits on the right, which suggests that, you know, probably first something from the basis is put in pivot position and then all the rest is moved out. But, you know, I will leave the details of this to the likes of Yvette or Luigi to figure out exactly how this goes. But look at what happens. So here you have, he saw every person, okay? He saw every person. And here you have the verb first, the object, and the subject, which is in the pivot position, okay? Which is on the right. So this is, the subject is elevated to pivot, which is like a topic-like position. And of course, the subject, the object cannot bind into the subject. This is a canonical, strong crossover-like configuration, okay? The interesting thing is that here he is on the right. So linearly, in terms of anaphora, it could work, right? The antecedent precedes linearly the pronoun, okay? So where is the left to right stuff, right? Here, you elect to pivot the object. Right? So you move into this position of prominence, the object. Right? So see, he, every person. It still means the same, but the pivot is the object. And of course, binding is still impossible. Right? Still against strong crossover. Yeah. All right, now we change to his mother hugged every child. Okay, so instead of he hugged every child, his mother hugged every child. Okay, now if you elevate his mother to the pivot position, the word order will be hug every child, his mother. And bad. But now, you promote to pivot every child, the object. And it becomes good. So the quirk here is that his mother follows every child. Right? So, linear order has nothing to do, you know, shouldn't we be telling this to the world? Okay. So even this simple descriptive point for me is enough. If you get it and if you see its robustness, I am happy. I can join Luigi in nights of wine and... all right. So, this is a summary of the facts. And again, I'm happy with just showing this pattern. Right? So, this is a set of facts that hangs together. He complained to no one. He complained at no student's defense. This is what falls under the rubric of strong crossover. His teacher complained to no students. His parents complained to no students' defense. Weak crossover. Overt WH movement preserves both these effects. But topicalization only preserves strong crossover. Okay? And why? Yeah? But as Luigi was underscoring, I'm going to try to tell you why. When should I shut up?
You said we have 15, 20 minutes.
So I will give you some sense of where I think this is headed. But, you know, this is real stuff. This is something robust that children exposed to, regardless of the specific shape, whether they're born in Taiwan or they're born in Italy, they converge on them. And, you know, a good description is always the first key step towards some kind of an account, right? And perhaps my account remains descriptive in this sense. But I think that what is going on is that there are really two kinds of variables, two kinds of operator variables, dependencies in the languages of the world. And one is what we know and love from classical logic. And the paradigm of that is the lambda operator. Okay? So you have a variable and you're binding with an operator, that, and that operator tells you what to do with that variable, how many times you have to interpret it, and so on. And this is subject to a strict C-command condition in the sense that the operator has to be able to reach that variable. Right, and so it, you know, it the variable has to be in scope. In a logical formula, if you have this configuration, this variable would not get the same meaning as that variable. This is a free one, this is a bound one. So this is, you know, the pain that you go through when you are exposed to intro to semantics. You have to learn this stuff. Okay, so this is very familiar, we know it, and this is essentially implemented as movement in language. Right? And then there is a different way of creating a covariance, and that's the dynamic idea. Okay, the dynamic idea works as follows. There are certain spots where you activate a file in your head. You activate a discourse marker, a discourse referent. And this discourse referent can be picked up indefinitely until you hit a barrier. And the barrier is created by either something like negation or something like a strong quantifier. Okay? And this is an asymmetric relation. So it goes on following the C-command chain. Right? So that if A C-commands B asymmetrically, the discourse marker is passed on. But if it's introduced in B, which is asymmetrically C-commanded by something, it cannot be passed backwards. Okay? So this is a different constraint. It's called accessibility. And it's rooted in the meaning of the connectives and of the quantifiers. To get a sense of it, here is an example. So there was a cat on the mat. It was black. I chased it away. And you could keep going, referring to the cat. This can happen, for instance, also in the antecedent of a conditional. If there is a cat on the mat and it was black and you chase it away, then tell me. Okay. Negation blocks that. There wasn't a cat on the mat. I saw it on the kitchen table. That's not good. Right? So negation screens off this passing off of the potential antecedent. This is a weak quantifier. A friend of mine brought his cat. It was a very annoying one. I chased it away, and so on. But every friend of mine brought his cat. It was annoying, and not very good. every creates a screen that blocks this free passing on of discourse reference. Okay. All right. So we have two kinds of operator binding relation. Okay, one is similar to lambda abstraction, and the other is similar to this mechanism of introduction of a file, opening of a file, opening of a discourse marker, and then the semantics of the embedding operators tell you how far you can push it. This is the very simple-minded mapping hypothesis. How are these operators employed by syntax? Okay. Now, a fairly natural assumption to make is that discourse markers are not activated by DPs. They are activated by positions, by heads, for instance. And in particular, thematic heads that assign primary thematic role, like agent and patient, always activate discourse markers, always create a potential antecedent. And then the question becomes, this is essentially saying that base positions, A positions, activate discourse markers. What about derived positions? Well, obviously, they must fall into two categories. Right? Some of them will activate discourse markers, and others won't. Okay? And we'll have to figure out which through the sweat of our eyebrow. But there is a clear initial hypothesis. Namely, if you are topic-like, you activate a discourse marker. If you are a position created to discharge scope, you don't. You don't have enough power to introduce a discourse marker. And as I said, this might be descriptive, though intuitive, but it's not a bad start, and it's, you know, makes sense of a lot of things. And in particular, it immediately makes sense of crossover phenomena. Okay? So in a simple sentence, of this form, someone or everyone petted his cat, you have two thematic roles, hence two discourse markers. Right? And the discourse marker activated in subject position will be accessible to the object, but not vice versa. Okay? And so this means that the sentence initial guy doesn't have any discourse marker accessible to any pronoun. And if you move things just to discharge scope, nothing is going to change. You get the idea, right? So a simple sentence is just the thematic roles that activate discourse marker in an asymmetric way. If you move things around to discharge scope, that won't change it. The initial guy won't have any discourse marker that it can assess. And that's the end of the story. So this is a simple story that generalizes both strong and weak crossover. Now, what about partial crossover override that we saw? Right? We saw in this, for languages, in this topic-oriented constructions. Well, topic-oriented construction do activate discourse marker. Right? So if you have a head, a topic head that attracts something, that head will introduce a discourse marker. And so that type of movement will create a potential antecedent. But then why strong crossover persists? I'd say just minimality. So take this, who did he complain to? Right? Or who did he say Mary complained to? Or who did Sue say that he believed? You can do that until you are blue in the face. All of these are going to be bad. And they're going to be bad whether the movement is for scope discharging or whether it's a topic-driven movement. Why? Well, you have a head, say the comp, that targets something with a certain index. If a pronoun intervenes in the C command chain, how can it possibly not interfere? So I say this is an open and shut case of minimality. And that's why it persists across all sort of movements. And I'd say this extends to good old QR. Right? You've got to imagine the QR is driven by a head, a la, say, Begelian Stowell, or, you know, that line of work. But there are designated positions that attract quantifiers, but they're not strong enough to create a discourse marker. But still, you're going to get very strong principle C, i.e. minimality effects. And, you know, this begins to make sense. Right, so this is the balance, and I will, you know, there is so much that I would have liked to discuss with you, you know, with Luigi, with Pierre, who has thought about these things a lot, because I think that there is a real fruitful overhaul of the binding theory that can be done from this point of view. But basically, I would say, you know, this is on the road. Again, it's very much on the road. And of course, the minute that you glean some kind of solution, of course, other problems pop up, and, you know, in the usual, hopefully virtuous dynamic. But I would say, you know, there are good old familiar Tarski-style variables. They are clearly what is involved in movement. When you move something, the moved thing will bind, a la Tarski, the thing it leaves behind. Right. And so that will be subject to C command in virtue of the nature of movement. And then there is the dynamics, where discourse markers, files, are activated by heads, essentially. And these heads have to have enough semantic bite, either by being the recipient of a theta role or the assigners of a theta role, or by being topic-like. I do not mean to exclude. You know, it's conceivable that also certain kind of focus driven movement might have the effect of introducing discourse marker, but it's not as smooth as with topics. Heads that trigger movement for the purposes of scope marking won't activate discourse markers. So WH movement and the likes won't activate discourse marker. Weak crossover is caused by movement to scope sites that don't activate discourse marker. Strong crossover is a minimality effect and hence cuts across all sort of movement. Whether I'm right or wrong, notice that we keep figuring out pretty incredible generalizations that are robust and far beyond the reach of ChatGPT, as Luigi has illustrated in one of his previous classes. Right? ChatGPT cannot get "he likes John," right? Let alone Siddiq, right? Where the bindi always sits to the right. So we keep discovering super interesting generalization, and we keep refining the way in which syntax and logic, which is the real source of meaning, come together. Okay, thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.